The King of the North, Part 1, by A. Winter Moore, which appeared in the Testimony magazine for January 1956. When Britain defeated the Turk in 1918 and expelled him from Palestine, many did not realize that we were witnessing the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy in chapter 11, in which the king of the north was to come to his end with none to help him. For at that time, most were obsessed with the idea that Daniel's king of the north and Ezekiel's Gog were one and the same. Also, attention was diverted by Britain being given the mandate over Palestine. Therefore, few noted the amazing manner in which Daniel's prophecy was then fulfilled. The object of this article is to draw attention to that fulfillment, which, after a lapse of some 40 years, we can perhaps now see in its true perspective. Before we consider this prophecy in detail, it might be well to review the evidence which proves that the king of the north is not Gog. For unfortunately, some misunderstanding still exists on this point. We are told that Gog is to come from the uttermost parts of the north, but there was nothing to suggest that the king of the north would do so. Do not let us be misled by his title, for it obviously did not even imply he was to come from the north, let alone the far north, for none of the other kings of the north referred to in the previous verses of the 11th chapter of Daniel say so. They were given the title of kings of the north solely because they occupied Palestine and Syria, countries to the north of Egypt, where the king of the south was established. They were kings of the north only in contradistinction to the kings of the south. With these facts before us, it is clear that the Turk became king of the north only when he took over the territories occupied by the original kings of the north. That he happened to come from still further north had nothing to do with his title. The very manner in which Daniel and Ezekiel described the respective invasions of the king of the north and Gog was proof that these powers were not the same. For whereas Ezekiel repeatedly refers to the fact that when Gog descends as a cloud to cover the land, the Jews are to be in occupation of Palestine, Daniel makes no mention of any Jews being there when the king of the north arrives. For apart from odd individuals, there were no Jews in Palestine when the Turks took possession in 1516. The object of Gog's invasion is made very clear by Ezekiel. He's come to take a spoil of the wealth which Israel has acquired since she became established in the land. And Daniel makes much of the spoiling of Egypt's goods by the king of the north. But he does not mention Israel's wealth. For how could the Turks spoil Israel when Israel was not there to be spoiled? That the king of the north is not Gog is definitely proved by the important difference in the composition of their armies. Gog's army is to include soldiers of the very prominent nation of Persia. But there's no mention of Persians in the army of the king of the north. It is difficult to believe that it was a mere oversight on the part of Daniel, for he was a captive of the Persians and would therefore have that country very much in mind. Was it not rather that the Spirit foreknew that Turkey would never subjugate Persia, and that Persian troops would therefore never be in his train? There are several items to which Daniel refers, but which are not mentioned by Ezekiel. Tidings from the east and the north were to trouble the king of the north, and as we shall see later, such tidings certainly troubled the Turk when he was in possession of Palestine. But there is no mention of Ezekiel's Gog being troubled by news from those quarters. Furthermore, Ezekiel does not tell us that Edom, Moab, and Ammon are to escape from Gog. But Daniel makes a point of the fact that those countries were not to come under the control of the Turk, which history tells us they never did. Apart from the fact that Ethiopia and Libya happen to be both with the King of the North and with Gog, there's nothing in the records to suggest that these potentates are one and the same. And here the accounts do not really suggest it, for whereas Ezekiel includes Ethiopia and Libya as part of a great concourse of people with Gog, Ethiopia and Libya are the only two nations with Daniel's King of the North. Furthermore, the record did not state that they were with him when he entered the glorious land, but only after he had subjugated Egypt, which was exactly the case with Turkey, Ethiopia, and Libya. Some may regard as evidence that the King of the North and Gog are one and believe that both are to appear at the same time, but that belief is not supported by the scriptures, as I hope to prove in the second article on this subject. Recent history has proved what is perhaps the most conclusive evidence that the Turk was the King of the North. Ever since, faithful men have endeavoured to interpret God's prophecies concerning the return of his people to his land. There have been many who have held that the return would synchronise with the drying up of the river Euphrates, which implied the elimination of the Turk. James by Kino, of whom Dr. Thomas thought so very highly that he actually regarded him as one of God's witnesses, mentioned in the Revelation, published a book in 1800 entitled The Restoration of the Jews and the Crisis of All Nations, in which he said, by comparing the beginning of the 12th chapter of Daniel with the latter part of the 11th chapter, and these again with Revelation 19, it is easy to perceive that the deliverance and restoration of the Jews is to take place at the time of the fall of the Ottoman power, that the King of the North means the Turkish power. All our ablest commentators agree. It is generally accepted that the Archangel Michael has been entrusted with the care of the Jews. Therefore, when Daniel tells us that when the King of the North comes to his end, Michael is to stand up, it means that he is to become specially active in his work for the Jews. Coming to his end apparently meant the end of the Turk's connection with Palestine, for the prophet was not referring to Turkey's end as a nation, but his end as King of the North. Events have proved that it was as a result of the expulsion of the Turk from Palestine that the way was opened for the Jew to return there. Therefore, by Kino's anticipation of 150 years ago, has been realized to the full, which proves that he was right in identifying the Turk as the king of the north. The 11th chapter of Daniel reads as follows: "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries, and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries, that is, shall be overthrown. But these shall escape out of his hands: Edom and Moab, and chief of the children of Ammon. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. The king of the south was the Saracen power, which pushed at the Roman power in Palestine. By defeating the Roman emperor Heraclius there in AD 636, thus ending the 700 years Roman occupation of the glorious land. The Saracen became the king of the south because he occupied Egypt, the territory of the original kings of the south. It was in 1516 that Selim I, the Sultan of Turkey, the king of the north, that is, made war upon the Sultan of Egypt, that is, the king of the south, who was then in possession of Palestine and Syria. It was a whirlwind campaign, for Selim did not declare war until he was quite ready, and then descended suddenly upon the unprepared king of the south, who was utterly defeated and killed in the Battle of Merj Davik in Syria. No battle was fought in Palestine. The king of the north merely entered that country on his way to Egypt as he chased his defeated enemy south. And a final battle was fought near Cairo 6 months later, which destroyed the king of the south. It is significant, therefore, that we read no more about the king of the south after verse 40, for the Turkish the king of the north had eliminated him. All this agrees perfectly with Daniel's statement: he shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Stretching forth the hand implies aggression, but entering suggests that there was no resistance, and actually there was none in Palestine. When he entered and occupied Palestine, the Turk did not subjugate Edom, Moab, and Ammon. And right to the end of his long occupation, the wild Bedouin tribes of those parts remained beyond his control. Verse 43 deals with the Turkish control of Egypt. And those who have studied Egyptian history during that period will have realized how exactly that control was predicted by Daniel in the words: "He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt." For the Turk did not occupy Egypt, but merely placed that country under tribute. It is not generally known that Egypt continued to pay that tribute for no less than 400 years, and that she paid it even after Britain took charge in 1882, for she paid it until the 1914-18 war, and even as late as 1866, the Turk almost doubled the amount due by increasing it from 370,000 to £720,000 per annum. So much power did he have over the treasures of silver and gold and over all the precious things of Egypt that until the Turk came to his end as the king of the north in 1918, Egypt was not even allowed to raise a loan without first obtaining the permission of Turkey. When Britain entered Egypt in 1882, many thought that Britain was the king of the south and was so preoccupied with that idea that few noticed the remarkable manner in which the Turk still retained his power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. If there were no other means of identifying Turkey in prophecy, and there are many, this alone should suffice to identify him as the King of the North. Verses 44 and 45 refer to the circumstances under which the Turkish armies entered Palestine in 1915 and were driven out in 1918. In the Authorized Version of the Bible, verse 45 reads, "And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain." But the Revised Standard Version of 1952 introduces a notable change, for it reads, "And he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious mountain." And this agrees with the rendering of the Revised Version of 1885. Palatial tents apparently means military headquarters. We must not expect the language used by the prophets to agree perfectly with modern conditions of warfare. Ezekiel says of Gog's army, all of them clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shields, all of them handling swords. These we must interpret as being the modern arms of this atomic age. The prophets used the language of their day, and in Daniel's day it was customary for the king to lead or at least accompany his troops on a campaign, and for his accommodation no doubt palatial tents were provided. When Nebuchadnezzar invaded Egypt, Jeremiah spoke of his royal pavilion being spread at Tahpenes. And when Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, besieged Samaria and received King Ahab's message, we are told that he was drinking, he and the kings, in the pavilions, or as the margin reads, tents. There's little doubt, therefore, that Daniel's palatial tents refers to the military headquarters of the King of the North. As we have seen, the Turkish King of the North did not pitch his palatial tents in Palestine when he first entered the land in 1516. He merely passed through on his way to Egypt. And so, lacking in incident was the history of Palestine throughout the bulk of the Turk's long occupation, that it is doubtful whether he could have said to have at any time pitched his palatial tents there, until he did so in 1915, for on no previous occasion did he enter the land as an aggressor. In peacetime, the Turk never stationed an army in Palestine. Therefore, he never had a military headquarters there. His fifth army was in Syria with its headquarters at Damascus, and his sixth army in Mesopotamia with its headquarters at Baghdad. The only Turkish troops in Palestine were in significant numbers engaged on police duties. The Turk established military headquarters in Palestine, perhaps for the very first time, when his 7th and 8th armies entered in 1915, and then, remarkable to relate, he pitched his palatial tents or established his military headquarters at Ramla, which is correctly described as being between the Holy Mountain and the sea, for it lies on the road from Jerusalem to the nearest seaport, Jaffa. Thus, Daniel's prophecy was fulfilled to the very letter. One might have expected Jerusalem to be chosen as the headquarters. But although that city was the political capital, the Turkish army never operated from it. Therefore, Jerusalem was surrendered in December 1917 without a shot being fired. Verse 44 reads, "Therefore shall he go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many." This language may suggest something the prophet never intended, namely that the king of the north was to be exceptionally wrathful and destructive, whereas all it was probably intended to convey was that the events were to take place in wartime, when violent passions are aroused, and also that he was to be the aggressor, thus contrasting with the king of the north mentioned in verse 24, who was to enter peaceably even upon the fattest place of the province, or the one in verse 20 who was to be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. We have already noted that two separate invasions of the Turkish king of the north were referred to by Daniel. The first was described in the words, "and many shall be overthrown." Many were overthrown by the change of government from Egyptian to Turkish in 1516. But it was a bloodless revolution because there was no opposition. Therefore, no one was destroyed. But when the Turkish king of the north was to pitch his palatial tent in Palestine in 1915, he was to go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many, which aptly described the bitter fighting of the 1915 to 1918 war in Palestine. Judged by biblical standards, the end of the Turkish king of the north was the most important event in world history since the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans and the expulsion of the Jews from Palestine. For it paved the way for the Jews' return. It is surprising, therefore, that Daniel should use particularly... Is it surprising, therefore, that Daniel should use particularly graphic language in describing that event? In the same verse we read, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him." It has been suggested that those points of the compass were in relation to the Turk's capital at Constantinople. But would it not be better to look for evil tidings coming from the east and north in relation to the Turk's occupation of Palestine? All other happenings recorded in chapter 11 were coordinated with God's land. For if we do so, we shall find that the prophecy was fulfilled to a truly remarkable degree. Why was the east mentioned first? Presumably because most of the Turks' troubles were to come from that direction. And note, how completely this came to pass. In the early stages of her conflict with Britain and her allies, the Turk made some attempt to recruit the sympathies of the Mohammedan population of the Near and Middle East by declaring that the war he was waging was a holy war, a revival of the holy wars by which the Mohammedan religion had been first spread when the Saracen hordes had conquered country after country with a battle cry of death to the infidel. The infidel being anybody who was not Muslim. That attempt not only failed, but it rebounded by the emir or grand sheriff of Mecca starting a religious war against the Turk himself. It was in that revolt that Lawrence of Arabia was later to gain fame. In June 1917, the Arab revolutionaries under King Hussein occupied Aqaba, the ancient Ezion Geber, and from then onwards the bulk of the Arab warlike operations against the Turk were in Edom, Moab and Ammon, countries to the east of Palestine. And countries that, as Daniel had prophesied, had escaped out of the hand of the Turkish king of the north. In fact, it was that escape that made the Arab revolt possible, for the Turk had always been impotent in those parts. Some authorities believe that the Arab revolt was the determining factor in Turkey's downfall. In any case, it is clear that the Turk had good reason to be troubled by tidings from the east on that head alone, but those were by no means all the evil tidings that came from the east. What was it that enabled us to identify the Turk in the book of Revelation, but his occupation of the territory through which the river Euphrates flowed? There was much variety of opinion regarding the meaning of many of the symbols used by the Hebrew prophets, but most commentators were agreed that the drying up of the Euphrates referred to the decline of the Turkish Empire. For exactly 400 years, the Turk had been in possession of Mesopotamia, which included the Euphrates Valley and which lay to the east of Palestine, but in 1917 the British were slowly driving him out, and after some initial reverses, Britain's progress was continuous. First Kut al-Amara, then Baghdad, and finally Mosul were captured, and with the signing of the armistice on October 30th, 1918, which necessitated the surrender of Mesopotamia as well as Palestine, the last pool of Turkish possessions in the Euphrates Valley was dried to extinction. That news was perhaps the bitterest of all the many evil tidings from the east which troubled the Turkish king of the north as he operated in the glorious land during the 1914-18 war. There were still other perils from the east to trouble the Turk. After the capture of Jerusalem by General Allenby, the Turkish armies were situated mainly in the Sumerian hills, still between the Holy Mountain and the sea, and were supplied by a branch of the Hejaz Railway, which joined up with the main line at Deraa, a station to the east of Palestine. Allenby depended on strategy for the final knockout blow by feinting as if he were going to deliver it from the Jordan Valley to the east, and then, when his enemy was off his guard, attacking him from the plain of Sharon to the west, and thus encircling him. At the same time, Allenby's air force and Faisal's Arab army between them destroyed the Turks' only means of escape, again to the east, by the Afula Dera railway. Therefore, when the final debacle came, the Turk was troubled by tidings from the east which proved to be false tidings, and before he had time to recover from the shock, he learned the true evil tidings, that his only escape route, which was also to the east, had been cut. It is unnecessary to draw attention to the fact that the Turk was also troubled by news from the north. The slow strangulation of Germany, his principal ally, and the early elimination of Bulgaria, to be followed by Austria, made the Turk realize that he must inevitably come to his end with none to help him, as indeed he did. It is not surprising that Daniel places the Eastern tidings as of first importance. The very composition of the armies that defeated the Turk was Eastern. The defence of the Suez Canal against his attacks was largely entrusted to Indian troops, and the bulk of Allenby's army for the final drive was recruited from Indian regiments. In view of the fact that the Turk had tried to whip up enthusiasm for a holy war against the Christian infidel, and thereby to put the Mohammedan population of the Near and Middle East against Britain, it must have been particularly galling for him to realize that Mohammedans have become his most dangerous enemies, that co-religionists were responsible for his downfall. Those who have seen the monument in the Mohammedan cemetery under the wall of Jerusalem, erected to the memory of the many Indian and Egyptian soldiers who fell fighting the Turk on the behalf of the British in the 1914-18 war in Palestine, may have marvelled at the workings of divine providence, whereby Mohammedan was set against Mohammedan when the King of the North was driven from the glorious land. In his book With Lawrence in Arabia, Lowell Thomas describes Allenby's campaign in Palestine in the following words: "In this, the most brilliant and spectacular military operation in the world's history, Allenby and Lawrence only lost 450 men, although they completely annihilated the Turkish army, captured over 300,000 Turks, advanced more than 300 miles in less than a month, and broke the backbone of the Turkish Empire." Although all did not use such enthusiastic language, it was generally admitted that Allenby's victory did much to ensure the final victory of Allied arms on all fronts in the 1914-18 war. And he was given the title of Lord Allenby of Megiddo because he delivered the death blow to the Turkish forces on the plain of Armageddon. A reminder that an even more outstanding victory will be effected in that area. There were many Germans fighting with the Turks in Palestine, but though they started as allies, the ill feeling between them became so intense that towards the end they often came to blows with one another. Therefore, the Times newspaper, that is presumably History of the War, when describing the plight of the Turk in the closing days of the Palestine campaign, said, save for some alien plantations such as the Kurds and Circassians, the Turk had not a friend in Syria. It might have added, nor in the whole world, for had not Daniel predicted, he shall come to his end, and none shall help him.